So I joined Facebook back in 2011, working mainly with Republicans through the 2012 campaign. And then I said to my boss and to the company that, because in 2012, Google was really the main, and YouTube was the main tech company that was being seen as influential in elections. And I told my boss, I really think 2016 needs to be the Facebook election, and I think you should let me run that. As he said, I hit that, landed that one a little bit hard. And I think, though, it was a confluence. This has been such a learning experience for me, and for the company as a whole, as we look at all of these different things happening, coming together. So I started building out the global team in 2013. And using some, I was building our election day reminders, which Katie mentions, me having to run digital, I had to learn how to do DreamWorks and build out a website, and all that came in really handy for my jobs. But after 2016, obviously, there were things, everyone had been so optimistic about the internet up till 2016. Everyone thought it was the great leveler, it was gonna be a great thing for democracy. You saw the Arab Spring happen, everything like that. Everyone thought everything was great. And now we were like, and then everyone saw the bad that could happen. And so we've had to dramatically dramatically pivot to start to think about how we can mitigate the bad. And I'm not seeing something so cross-company focused since we've made the big shift to mobile in 2012. So there's been five main things that we've been working on that have been a part of my work, all of which I have no doubt in a few years are going to be PhD thesis topics for people here at the university. So Katie, I have a lot of ideas. The first is when we looked at what bad actors were doing on the platform and how people were trying to manipulate the platform, whether foreign or domestic, what's the first commonality between them all? They're using fake accounts. So on Facebook, we require you to use your real name. You can only have one account. And for the most part, bad actors are not going to be using their real account, because whether you're here in the US or you're in Russia, you probably don't want your friends and family to know that you're a troll, and you're an online troll, and you're doing this stuff. Or you create multiple accounts in which to try to evade our various detection systems. So we were already pretty good at getting to automated accounts, like people writing scripts and creating automated accounts. What was hard was there were a room full of people like this, creating accounts, trying to make them seem like real people. And they started making them many years back. If you look at some of the Mueller reports already in indictments, they started this in 2014, the IRA, in terms of creating some of these accounts to try to make them seem like real people. So we have gotten better at using machine learning to be able to detect the difference between, are you a real new user on Facebook, or maybe you just creating this account to try to spread information. I use my dad as an example. So my dad, Merrill native, lives in Green Bay still, and finally got him on Facebook last year. Friend of my mom, my brother, my sister, and I, yeah, you can do the math how long I worked there until he actually joined. He didn't post a lot, he was kind of just learning how this whole Facebook thing worked. Whereas, if you look at people who create accounts to spread misinformation or spread things, they're friending hundreds of people right away. They don't have a lot of connections to one another. They're joining a lot of groups. They're liking a lot of pages because they're trying to share these links in all these different spots. So by using machine learning, we can get better at detecting that and potentially taking them down. The second thing was that if you look at what the IRA was doing on our platform, so there were two main things that, when you think about right after 2016, the topic was not foreign interference. The topic was false news. Then it became, and the topic was, what did the Trump campaign do on Facebook, and what did they do online? How did they vest the best Obama brains who had been working for Hillary? And they were looking at Facebook, and they were looking at the advertising that the campaign was doing. And then people had a lot of questions about the advertising that the IRA had been doing on our platform. So the second thing we've been working a lot on, and I've been working a ton on, is bringing ad transparency to Facebook ads. We were far from perfect this time in terms of doing it. And I don't say this as an excuse, it's just the truth. Like, it's really complicated. Like, you have both the FEC and then you have over 8,000 different electoral but regulatory bodies just in the states, in terms that people can register with different rules at all different levels around it. But we ended up deterring. We saw with some of the takedowns that we did where we found interference, particularly from Iran, where they had tried to run ads on our platform after we launched this, and then they didn't because they were deterred by having to provide an ID and having to make their ads transparent and say who was paying for them. But we have a long way to go in terms of trying to make sure that what people put, so with our ad transparency, I should back up, sorry. We require people now, if you want to run political or issue ads on Facebook or Instagram, you have to first authorize, show us a copy of your ID, last 4 digits of your social, and we even use snail mail to send you a postcard to your home to make sure you live here in the States. Then we require you to put in a disclaimer, and right now we just look for that disclaimer to make sure that it doesn't say things like Mickey Mouse. But then over the last couple of weeks, we've been trying to get even stricter on that, and then we're gonna be adding even more going into 2020. But that's where it gets really difficult because there's not a single database for us to ping up against to make sure that an organization is legit. And then those ads go into an archive where they will be there for 7 years. And you can go and look at these ads right now. And you can see the range of the number of impressions that ad got, range of the budget that was spent, and then the age, gender, and location by state of who saw that ad. So this has brought, we've seen a ton of really interesting reporting, particularly in the primaries, of looking at the different media strategies that campaigns have done, and a lot of the folks that won their primaries, you saw big differences where one campaign was doing mostly digital and one campaign was doing mostly traditional TV, print, etc. Both us, Google, and Twitter all have these ad transparency tools now that you can go look at those ads. The third thing that we've been doing a lot of work on is around fighting misinformation. Now, our general principle that we follow is we try to root it in free speech as much as possible. So Katie has a right to say the sun rises in the west. She does not have a right for us to amplify that. Now, that's a controversial position to be in because I sit in a lot of rooms and people are like, well, why didn't you just delete? Like, that is clearly false. Why are you not deleting it? Which is a completely fair debate for the society to have, and I think we need to keep having it before we come to a commonality of what people are allowed to say when it comes to free speech. But when we look at false news, we look at it in a couple of ways. So first of all, if it violates our community standards, it's coming down. If it violates hate speech, with voter fraud, we were looking at people were saying Republicans vote Tuesday, Democrats vote Wednesday, that stuff was coming down. Then the trickier part is where there's some truths and a lie in a story. When you look at the stories that were coming out of the 2016 election initially, it was a bunch of Macedonian teenagers who were running websites to get clicks on Facebook to make money. And you see this phenomenon not just internationally, but a lot domestically as well in different countries. And so we, again, using machine learning and as much as we could, we can find if a link on Facebook goes to a website that's mostly ads. We call them ad farms. And we can immediately downrank or reduce the reach of that content. The same thing if it's a clickbaity headline, like, woman jumps in pool, you won't believe what happens next. Those things we can now, we've gotten pretty good at learning, and we can immediately reduce the reach. For those we aren't sure on, we send to our fact checkers, and with the fact checkers, we work with third-party fact checkers, so they're not employed by Facebook. We work with Pointer, their international fact-checking consortium. And so these are folks like Associated Press, PolitiFact, Snopes, etc. And what they do is they get access to a dashboard, and we share with them, here's the links that are being shared on Facebook, and if you want to mark them false or not, you can. So if they mark a link as false, and now actually we do photos and videos too, we send a notification to anybody who shared that content, so they know it's been marked false. We also show if people happen to see it. So again, Katie shares sun rises in the west. If I go to her profile and I see that, I'm going to see related articles underneath being like, no, this has been fact-checked. It rises in the east. And then if I try to share that, I will also get a notification. Now, what's been fascinating about this is when we initially launched this, we put a big red disputed flag on the content, like just glaring at people that it's false. You know what we found? Made people believe it even more. So this has been a huge, this is a challenge not just on Facebook, but I think that's something we are facing overall, is about people wanting to see news that reinforces their preconceived beliefs. And even if it's not as simple as just showing them the other side to get them to consider it. And it's something really interesting that we're working with a lot of researchers, psychologists, and other sociologists, political scientists. I'm trying to think about what is the best user interface and design to really get people to consider other viewpoints when they're looking at some of these stories. So that's the third thing. The fourth thing is just disrupting bad actors overall. So we set up a lot of different dashboards and things with our engineers and data scientists to try to find ways so that we could be alerted if content might be being spread on Facebook that might not be from that country. So for instance, we can first classify, is the content civic or not? And then we look at, is there civic content, for instance, spreading in the US on Facebook that is coming from pages with foreign admins? Now that could be a BBC article. Their admins are in London. That's pretty normal. That's okay. Or it could be something else. But it gives us a signal for our threat intelligence and information operations teams in order to dig into this a little bit more and then potentially find networks of pages and accounts that these folks are running. We've announced a variety of takedowns. Both in Mexico and Brazil, we found networks that we call it fake civic engagement. So they weren't necessarily spreading URLs, but they were going to actual politician pages and others and liking the content right away and sharing it to try to make it seem more popular than what it was. And so these, you often hear them called like farms, but they're not just going and becoming fans of these pages, they're engaging with the content overall. We also just found in August, we announced a big takedown from Iran, where they were targeting a wide variety of countries here around the globe. That was over 500 pages. And then the other big thing too is we have really increased our partnerships, not just with government, but also with organizations like the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensics Research Lab, and also our fellow companies. And so we had been given a tip here right before the election about some additional accounts that the IRA was running that had actually, most of them were on Instagram. So we're seeing them move to other platforms because of some of the work that we're doing on, and so at Facebook, we own Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. So for us, we're trying to do more on what we can do cross-platform as well. But this is gonna be something that, like, these are gonna be regular announcements that we're making. And what we're trying to do is fan out and find these networks as much as we can, because the minute we take action, then they know they've been caught. Which is a really interesting, I've learned a ton about threat intelligence and information operations in the last 2 years that I never thought I would have. But these folks are sophisticated in what they're doing. And then the other thing, and this is probably the hardest decision I've ever had to make at the company, was when we made the decision to take down some domestic actors. So when we look at this, we look at behavior. Are you having multiple fake accounts? Are you spamming groups with a bunch of URLs? Have you been warned multiple times that you're violating the rules and you continue to do so? And when we ran this same sort of, I don't want to call it algorithm, but when we took those principles, we ran it against domestic actors, we found pages on both the left and the right that were doing those types of things. And we took them down in October, which, if you want to go look at the Twitter hate on me feed, was not a popular thing. And I knew a lot of these folks that had been doing it, and I'd been trying to tell them the rules of the road about this. But it was a really difficult decision, and it's a really interesting conversation to have about free speech on the internet. Because again, this is about their behavior, not about what they were saying. But what they were saying, too, was also something that a lot of fact checkers would say was false, or was at least skirting the lines, which comes up to like just so many interesting questions. The final thing, though, and then I'll take your questions, is all on the positive front. We also do a lot of work on civic engagement. We do election day reminders for people. We do something where we show everyone who's going to be on their ballot I don't know about you, but even being a political junkie, I roll into the ballot and I don't know who's running for school board. What's this referendum? I allow the city of Arlington, Virginia to accept this debt for this thing. And the first time you're seeing it is on the ballot, right? When you walk into the booth. So we're trying to give people an opportunity to do that studying ahead of time and talk to friends ahead of time before they go into the polls. And then yesterday was Wednesday, we relaunched our town hall feature, which is where people can go see their newly elected representatives, follow them on Facebook, and then we have a whole co-governance team that then works to connect people with those that represent them. But tomorrow, the numbers are still being crunched, but right now it looks like I'll be doing a press call tomorrow. We'll be announcing some of those numbers of what we've seen. We also have people register to vote. And in 2016, we estimate we helped about 2 million people register to vote across the company, or country, sorry. I keep saying we mix up company and country. So with that, it's a lot of stuff. I'm happy to take any questions. I'll answer them best I can. I assume Jeff will try to moderate.
Right, so let me just ask, when you said IRA, do you mean the Irish Republican Army?
Yeah, that's good.
Oh, sorry, Internet Research Agency. So it's I'm a Republican. Russian Internet Research Agency.
Oh, okay.
I haven't slept much in the last couple of weeks.
I thought
you said that. No. I guess, sorry, I'm so baked in this that like I should have clarified.
All right, we're going to go to the audience. What do you think was the biggest lesson from this election year that's going to guide you for 2020, which is going to be 100 times worse, I think?
It is going to be 100 times worse. Lisa actually set up the physical war room that we weren't sure. So we've been doing this work virtually, meaning that we have teams from across the globe that are working on this. We work a lot in email and messenger. We don't necessarily all need to be in one physical spot. But we created that for the U.S. election in Brazil. And it worked quite well. I think though what we're gonna see, and we saw it with President Trump's caravan app that CNN rejected, and then we did, and NBC and Fox and everyone, I have a feeling they're gonna be pushing our community standards quite hard. And if we're gonna be forced to be making even more difficult decisions than what we had to in 2018. So we've gotta make sure we've got a really good set of principles that we're rooted in, so that we don't look like we're making biased decisions, and instead they're rooted in a set of principles that we believe in.
Okay, now watch out. This is a libertarian point of view.
Yeah, hey, Katie. So 2007, then Senator Barack Obama meets with the Silicon Valley oligarchs, right? You know, Eric Schmidt and Mark Zuckerberg and all that. Mm-hmm. And 2008, the Obama campaign makes extensive use of Facebook, and also 2012. So what changed from that time to 2016? Obviously, we know Facebook's data access policies for third parties changed big time, right? You pretty much closed that off after 2016, more or less. But early on, if you had access to the platform, you could pull the data out. I mean, I saw reports from the Democrat Party, for example, that aggregate.
Yeah, targeted sharing is touted as one of the best things that Obama did.
Exactly. So describe the evolution of that a bit and where we are today, because that was early days.
So this may not be the answer you want, but it's the answer. I've thought about this a lot, and I'm coming at this more from a Republican operative standpoint. So when I left UW, I graduated UW in 03, and I went out and worked for the RNC in 2003, President Bush's re-election campaign. Now, if you remember back then, the Republicans were being touted as the real innovators for using micro-targeting. 2002 and then 2004, and the Democrats were the ones who were like, oh my God, are we gonna catch up? Like, are we doing this well enough? And that came from the top and who the campaign managers were. That came from Karl Rove, that came from Ken Melman, that came from Ed Gillespie. The people who were running the parties and the campaigns were willing to take the risk and being innovative and understanding that that might mean they lose. And then they're told their strategies were wrong. But then what happens when you win is you're like, this is a winning strategy. I can't change a thing. I'm gonna keep doing the same thing I did. And then 2008, President Obama's campaign came around. And I was on Giuliani's in 07. And if you remember, everyone thought it was gonna be Giuliani and Hillary. And I couldn't get that. They were like, you can't be on Facebook. What if somebody says a bad comment? What if somebody does, because we had big targets on our back. And we were in the lead, and you had people there like, we ran President Bush's re-election in 2004, we know what we're doing, just go sit in your corner and go blog or do whatever it is the thing to do. And, but President Obama's campaign started from an underdog position. He had people like David Plouffe and Jim Messina who were willing to change, take those risks. And other campaigns, we tried them on the Rudy campaign too, some of our strategies. If any of you remember the vaulted Florida strategy, let's get Iowa and New Hampshire, be done with it. High risk, high reward. And the Obama team had a team that was willing to, both in 2008 and 2012, willing to be innovative. And then you look at 2016, and you had a Trump campaign that nobody thought would do anything, laughing them off. You don't have traditional political consultants. You're not doing this in the normal way. You have Jeb Bush running $100 million worth of television ads and not doing anything online. And you have the Trump team saying, all right, everyone come, you're just like a marketplace. You're gonna have to compete. I'm gonna test the heck out of this stuff and see what works. Then they're just talking about digital. But because they had the underdog, they had the underdog position, and they were willing to do things differently than what had traditionally been done in politics. Whereas the Clinton campaign and all the Obama folks were like, we want in 08, we want in 12. We know how this goes. And we were there, and I remember we would go to both campaigns and be like, hey, we know this is kind of crazy, but we just, like, this is something new. It's a couple weeks before the election, you want to try it out? The Trump team would be like, sure, let's figure it out. And the Clinton team would be like, no, we already have our processes in place, we already know what we want to do, we're good. So I'm not saying there's a lot that goes into this, but to me, it's not about the Facebook data and what was available, et cetera, et cetera. For me, it's about the culture of the campaigns and the willingness to adapt quickly. Look how much has changed. Again, I work at a company that didn't exist when I graduated. So, Katie's doing a little happy dance back there. But it's true. Like, at the beginning of 2012, we didn't have mobile ads. At the end of 2012, we did. Campaigns were like, we can't adapt that fast to what you guys are doing. So that's my theory, and I think that you should not underestimate the Trump campaign again for the re-election. I know that's not a popular thing to say, but
no, I agree.
I would highly recommend that you don't, like, they know how to adapt really well. They know how to take business practices and try to adapt it to, and how to adapt it to politics. And you look, for me, the real wake-up call, not real, but one of the big wake-up calls of 2016 was the third debate. I was in Vegas, and the Trump team was the first campaign ever to buy the rights to stream the debate themselves. And so they did their own programming. It looked like we were watching Fox. And they did their own programming on their Facebook page, and they switched over to the debate. You could watch the debate, and then it shifted back over to their own programming. They had more people watching their live stream than ABC News, who us as Facebook were driving everyone to from our homepage. That's insane. Like, the direct line that they have to folks is something that needs to be considered. We're thinking about all this. Sorry, that was a very long, rambling answer, but.
Okay, here's a question from Katie.
Sorry, it's a professor calling. So, quick question. So, I was really struck. I mean, I'm significantly older than you, and I remember back after, Bush v. Gore and the news networks calling the election too fast and getting hauled in front of Congress, and we were talking about the CEOs of every network sitting in front of congressional hearings. I was really struck in 2016, when we began to think about Russian influence in the election, that there were no CEOs in front of those congressional hearings. There was like a CEO and, whatever. But then, fast forward in front of or beyond Cambridge Analytica, there was Mark Zuckerberg looking pretty nervous and drinking a lot of water. So can you just...
That's a name call.
Okay, so could you just, off the record, of course...
No.
You can ask me that question tomorrow. What was the difference? What was the change in took us from, this isn't something we really have our leader talking about, to we are now having Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress and making all of these changes. What was the internal shift?
So the talk of changes really, so I don't want to say, the day of the election 2016 and the day after, I will always say there was before that election and after that election, just because, and I think that is for a lot of us for many different reasons. I do see some of this as an evolution of seeing what's been happening on the platform. I think, in all honesty, a lot of this is coming to grips with just the peer responsibility that we had with some of this, and the ability to make change quickly in a way that governments and regulators and others can't, or wouldn't, or might make the wrong decisions, or might make ones that have unintended consequences. Not saying that ours aren't, but like even look at the law in Germany around hate speech. A lot of, you know, that, a lot of questions around that. But I think that it was a culmination of, I think with Cambridge Analytica, it was finally this sort of, this thing that he had built in his dorm room. He now feels this responsibility to make sure there's free, fair elections around the world, and nobody else is stepping up to do it. So it's a very idealistic viewpoint that's sort of Silicon Valley and our company in terms of the mission facing. And I think part of that was pressure, and part of that is just like really coming to grips with what the platform was possible for, and the fact that people weren't using it for, the number of people using it for bad was growing so much quicker.
All right, question back here from Carlo.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Eat the mic. I want to take you back to the earlier section about fact-checking the content, except that it's actually political too. Because today I found myself looking at the video of something I actually watched live yesterday, which was, I'm sure you know where I'm going.
Yep, I do.
Jim Acosta, in what looks to somebody who's seen hundreds, if not thousands, of those press things, like a setup. Yeah, sorry, I got it. Like a setup. And then I'm told on Twitter that his that Sarah Sanders tweeted out a doctored version, and I can't tell the difference. And I realized, wow, people who were actually able to edit these videos are able to do things to them that are so sophisticated.
That's right.
After all, they do it in the
deep state, all the time.
Then they're actually going to be able to affect politics.
Yep.
I can't even believe my own lying eyes. Yep. So what on earth? I mean, if I saw it live and then I see a video, what on earth can Facebook do? Because I know that those videos are actually going to be what's really shared.
It is. Yeah. No, you're totally right, and it's something that we've been trying to build out. Machine learning, because we're worried not just about that, but then as many of you probably heard the term deep fake. So people are going to be able to create videos that make it seem like President Trump, and he's standing there speaking to you, and he's saying something he's never said. And then imagine with somebody like him or any other politician, if a video comes out, they're just going to say, that's not me, I never said that, that's a deep fake. And all they need to do is sow a little bit of misdirection and confusion into it to potentially just help them save themselves as part of the entire story. We're trying to think about both in terms of artificial intelligence and machine learning and all that. I'm saying a lot of fancy words, and I'm a journalism poli-sci major. I don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to that. But I do know that like what they're trying to do is use that to be able to, because with that video, you should be able to distinguish between many, because there are so many other cameras in that room, you should be able to distinguish, did somebody actually speed up the arm or not, to, you know, in terms of that. But it's going to get harder, and then in terms of whether or not the politician actually said something or not, and the more deep fakes. I'm actually more worried about people making it seem like a politician or somebody said something, and they actually haven't.
that's going to be a lot harder. So they're trying to work with, they're trying to literally make these videos and then have the real, like, real speech in front of them and try to see how can we do this with facial recognition and stuff too, around being able to say, okay, this is the true digital footprint of this video. Here's where it's altered. Here's where it might be fake. But then also trying to work with the fact checkers and all that stuff too. But that is absolutely on our, like, not just on our horizon, it's here now, of trying to think about as we look towards 2020.
Does that video fall? Did that video, the...
I'll have
video
to check,
was changed,
I don't know.
Would that go to your fact checker? Would something like that go to your fact checker?
Very likely, I don't know, but actually I wasn't following it super closely on the platform today to know whether or not that... What?
I did.
Oh, did?
Okay.
Thank you. Glad you know.
Well, it originated with InfoWars.
Well, no, but the... Yeah, there's a lot more to that, too.
But yes, it did go to the IFC.
Okay. Well, there's the other interesting thing, too. Yes, last night, was protesters went to Tucker Carlson's house and videotaped that and rang the doorbell and posted that up, and we ended up taking that down, too, for... For showing the guy's house, so.
So does it matter if who does the doctoring of a video? So if the White House does the doctoring of a video, or the House of Representatives, or Senator so and so, do you go, oh wait a minute, we can't send that to the fact checkers?
It's something we're discussing. Just being honest with you, I think it's a really tricky one because. People are going to want to discuss and share and condemn what the White House is doing, but you also don't want to allow the spread of that information necessarily either. My own personal belief is that I think we should fact check the politicians and we should show those related articles, but we shouldn't necessarily demote the reach of that content. But it's a very much ongoing open debate that if I asked all of us here, we would have very mixed opinions.
It also seems like an impossible task. I'm dominating this because I'm interested, but I mean, it seems like an impossible task. And then if you do it in the US, are you gonna do it in Brazil, or are you gonna do it in...
we have this worldwide.
Yes, so I mean, again, it seems like an impossible task. How many users do you have?
2.6 billion across all of our
apps. Only 2.6 billion. Okay, so anyway, it just seems like an impossible task because originally Facebook wasn't meant to be a magazine. It was just a sharing platform. Now you're turning it into an editing publication.
Yeah, it's not like your traditional press in terms of how you define it. There's a lot of things I feel like we're in the middle of redefining right now. In redefining what they are. There's a lot of people that want us to say we're a publisher, but we're not like a traditional publisher, but there are elements where we look like traditional publishers. When it comes to that ad transparency, the world is redefining what it means to be influencing the political discourse, and whether or not you should include news organizations in that, and how do you even define what a news organization is?
Well, this politics pretty much sets the standard for that.
It does. You're actually the one that I think every meeting with Mark and Cheryl, I'm like, this politics is here. Where does everybody else fall?
All right, I got to get a plug in for myself. Okay, anybody have any other questions? Raleigh, do you have a question?
No.
No? Okay. Okay, you get the last question here.
Well, I just had a comment.
No, go ahead, comment.
We ended the last panel where it was stated that people will be able to have the discernment to tell whether it's bad ads or this or that and truth. And in the 80s and 70s, so much research was done on paradigms, people reading things through their paradigms. And like you said, and Facebook has proven, people will read more even if they think it's false because it bellows what they believe, okay? And, you know, I don't know if there's a way to digitally market it, but I think we're in the age of that. So strongly, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. Does it reinforce who or what I think?
No, and some of the other things that we're trying to do as well is we've done this globally and here in the US, we partner with the museum on pushing out tips for people of trying to be able to spot false news and things for them to think about when they're reading things online. With that, we're also looking at what are different digital literacy campaigns we can do with schools, because you really need to start this education much younger in terms of helping people to be good digital citizens, both giving resources to kids and to parents about that, because there's such a gap oftentimes between what they understand. But it's a real challenge, and it's another thing too where we're trying to do a lot of partnerships with different folks on it. But I think we're just very much, I know it's not uplifting, but I just feel like we're very much in the beginning of trying to figure out what the best ways are for dealing with all of this that feels like it's come at us in just such a short period of time. And it hasn't been that long of a period of time after that for us to really even know if what we're doing is working or not.
Yeah, it sounds like they should be teaching media literacy from grade 3, perhaps. But that's but who would teach it and who would do it right? So anyway, I want to thank Katie Hartbath. Please give her a round of applause.